Radio Derb is on the air. Greetings, listeners, from your fastidiously genial host, John Derbyshire, here with a roundup of news and comment from the past week. To start us off, let's open the good book. This week's text is from the Gospel according to St. Matthew, chapter 23, verse 24. Quote, "Ye blind guides, which strain at a gnat and swallow a camel." End quote. Jesus really nailed it there. That's our ruling class and their media lackeys to a T. Or actually, I guess, since the Saviour was speaking Aramaic, to a tor. They make a great fuss, a great show of struggle and passion, trying to swallow a gnat. But the camel goes down with one smooth gulp. Some examples. Huge black junkie hoodlum dies of an OD while under restraint by small white cop. Nationwide struggle, passion, writhing, straining. On the other hand, a black cop shoots an unarmed white female veteran trespasser with no warning. Another example, Republican president's national security advisor makes courtesy calls to a Russian ambassador. Top-level investigations, endless prosecutions, years of struggle and straining. On the other hand, Democratic vice president's son's laptop reveals multi-million-dollar influence-peddling deals with Chinese and Ukrainian entities. Yet another example. Citizens protesting a rigged election get into the Capitol building, break a couple of windows, take selfies. Insurrection! Just like 9/11, says Nancy Pelosi. No, like Pearl Harbor, says Steve Cohen. The worst attack on our democracy since the Civil War, says Joe Biden. Rage, passion, a Congressional Select Committee. Straining. And on the other hand, anarchist mobs loot, burn and kill in cities all over. Dozens of deaths, billions in property damage. For the last few years, our news has been all like that. If you look closely at the big headline issues, the ones generating all the heat and noise in the mainstream media, there is nothing much there. Just a gnat. If you want to know what really matters, what is really nation-changing, you may, if you're lucky, catch a glimpse of it from item number 11 in your evening TV news, or on page 23 of your broadsheet newspaper, or in fringe internet outlets like, vide.com. Our regime and their media shills just swallow down that really major stuff, the camels, with hardly a burp. It's the same with big global issues. Noise, heat, rage, straining. All about nothing much. A gnat. Silence, indifference or facile optimism, That's when you know that there's something really big and important. A camel. That elites would much rather not be discussed in public. Consider, for example, two current issues with worldwide effect. Global warming and mass migration. I'll have a segment on each. The gnat and the camel. Today, November 12th, the UN Climate Change Conference, COP26, winds up in Glasgow, Scotland, after 2 weeks of presentations, discussions, partying, and celebrity schmoozing. The great and the good came from far and wide to express their concern for what is, according to them, an existential challenge to the human race. Is it, though? The Earth's overall mean temperature has risen by 1/7 of a degree Fahrenheit per decade since 1880. So in my lifetime, our planet got 1.1 degrees warmer. I suppose I should be ashamed to say it, but honestly, listener, I didn't even notice. How much hotter will the planet be at the end of this century? That, of course, depends on whether we go on doing just what we're doing or do something different. If we go on doing what we're doing, estimates go all the way up to 8.6 degrees, although, I'm quoting here from Discovery Magazine, February 15th this year, quote, some climate researchers caution that it's more of an upper bound possibility and is unlikely to occur, end quote. Probably I would notice that if I were around to notice it. We're not going to go on doing what we're doing for the next 80 years, though, any more than we're doing today what we were doing in 1940. Even without nagging from the climate alarmists, even if we don't all start eating beetles and travelling by rickshaw, technology changes of its own accord, generally in a cleaner and more efficient direction. Population changes too. World population has more than tripled since 1940. It's extremely unlikely to triple again by 2100. In the biggest energy-consuming nations of today, it will actually have declined. Unless someone figures out how to encourage people in these countries to make more babies. Which, so far, no one has. All things considered, my bet would be on a worldwide temperature rise, absent lifestyle upheavals like beetle eating and rickshaws, a rise in the range 3.5 to 5.5 degrees. That is 3 to 5 times what I have failed to notice in my own lifetime. Existential crisis? Nah, we'll adjust. But Derb, I hear you cry, what about rising sea levels? Well, those numbers come out similarly non-existential. Global mean sea level has risen about 7 inches in my lifetime, again without my noticing. The IPCC thinks a 1 to 3 feet further rise will happen if we go on doing what we're doing. But the same arguments apply. Again, I end up guessing that, even if we ignore the nagging from British royals, Swedish goblins and Hollywood airheads, the actual rise will be 3 or 4 times what I have failed to notice in my own lifetime. Meh. Yes, there will be localized issues, some of them locally existential. The world's lowest lying country is the Maldives, an archipelago in the ocean south of India. Average natural elevation, 5 feet above sea level. If that dwindles to 3 feet, the Maldivians are in a pickle. There are only 500,000 of them, though, and I'm sure India will take them in, if no other solution can be found. Yeah, they could be the world's first floating nation. Humanity always has problems to face, and we've successfully faced far bigger ones than global warming. All right, it's bigger than a gnat. It's a housefly, perhaps. For sure, it doesn't justify the hyperbole, hysteria, and celebrity virtue signalling that we've gotten this last 2 weeks from Glasgow. The camel, in this extended analogy that I'm running, the camel is demography. Or more precisely, the swelling mass movements of people from poophole countries with high fertility to civilized countries with low fertility. Here are 3 items from the non-headline news this past week. First item. The EU, the European Union, is being challenged by floods of migrants, most of them from the Middle East, trying to break into Poland, Lithuania and Latvia, which are all EU members, from Belarus, which isn't. The migrants are being flown into Belarus deliberately by that country's president for life, Alexander Lukashenko. He then sends them to the borders with those aforementioned EU members as revenge for EU sanctions against him. The degree to which this is Lukashenko's brainchild, as opposed to Vladimir Putin's, with Lukashenko just Putin's cat's paw, the degree to which that is the case is unclear. Second item. Britain is no longer in the EU, but that hasn't spared the Brits from illegal immigration woes. So far this year, more than 22,000 illegal immigrants have arrived in boats crossing the Channel from France. The British government has made clucking noises, but no real effort to stop the flow. The illegals are still officially referred to as asylum seekers, although no one in government has explained what is wrong with France as an asylum destination. Third item. A huge caravan of illegals from Central America is on its way north through Mexico. It should arrive at our southern border later this month. The caravan has a vanguard of young, violent, aggressive men in the front. Mexican police barricades have been no match for them. The Biden administration has so far expressed no concern or taken any action. Those 3 items represent a huge and growing crisis, far more pressing than climate change, and with few signs of the world elites, including American elites, having any clue what to do about it. Such hopeful signs as there are come from Europe. They especially come from Eastern Europe, from nations which only 30 years ago regained their sovereignty after decades under the Soviet heel. Poland is responding sturdily to Lukashenko's attempt to flood them with illegals. They now have multi-layer barriers of barbed wire coils the entire length of the border, and Poland's parliament has authorised the building of a wall. Lithuania and Latvia are showing similar resolution. And the EU itself seems to be waking up. The Union's political leadership, in its plodding way, has begun the process of helping to fund border walls. Quote from the Wall Street Journal, November 11th, quote, European officials and EU diplomats said that a number of governments were still reluctant to directly fund border walls because it is politically controversial. But several noted that a majority is tilting in favour of the demands by frontier states. That marks a profound shift from a near decade-long reluctance to pay for barriers. End quote. Given the speed at which things move in EU executive politics, Fortress Europe is some years away yet. It looks like it may happen, though. Fortress Britain and Fortress America are nowhere in sight. The Brits are totally cooked. The most common statements from the government there about the Channel boats is concern for the safety of the invaders, as if that was anyone's business but the invaders' own. As well as being cursed with spineless politicians and a defeated, apathetic public, Britain is further blighted by exceptionally wide-ranging so-called human rights laws and a large and vigorous establishment of human rights lawyers working them. These human rights seem to apply only to foreigners, especially illegal aliens. Just this week, the government tried to deport 37 illegal alien criminals to their native Jamaica. But the plane took off with only 4 people on board. Human rights lawyers had blocked the rest through legal action. And the British government I'm talking about here is in the hands of the Conservative Party. If Britain's more progressive party was in charge, they would be chartering luxury cruise ships to bring the invaders in. Listeners are, I'm sure, familiar with the US situation, especially since last month's fiasco with the Haitians and the ongoing seeding of red states with Afghans. Given that no one ever supposed that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris were conservatives, though, we are at least less crazy than the Brits. What is more important for a conservative party to conserve than the nation's borders? So that's my thesis. Peering forward through the coming decades, there are lesser things to worry about, and there are much, much greater things. There are gnats, and there are camels. Climate change is a gnat. Mass migration of peoples from crappy places to nice places is a camel. Our elites fuss and shout and strain over the gnat, but they swallow the camel in silence. One thing has an influence on the other, of course, as my example of the Maldives shows. That's a trivial example, though. Let's suppose you live in the nation of Niger, where the total fertility rate is 6.9 children per woman. And let's suppose that at some point between now and the year 2100, climate change makes agriculture in Niger, which is today only very difficult, makes it absolutely impossible. Then you, or your 6.9 children, or your 47.61 grandchildren, will likely be wanting to move to somewhere more salubrious. Note, please, that even without climate change, Niger's current population of 23.6 million will, by century's end, have increased to several hundred million, more than the current population of the entire European Union. Note also that Niger is only one of the 28 countries with total fertility rate greater than 4. All but one of them in sub-Saharan Africa. What is the one? It's Afghanistan. So yes, looking forward at the decades to come, humanity faces at least one colossal problem. And it's not climate change. Why then, why are the great and the good, the royals, movie stars, pop singers, progressive politicians, why are they jetting around the world for solemn conferences about climate change, when this greater and far more intractable problem is looming in plain sight? Why aren't the beautiful people congregating in Glasgow to discuss the defence of the civilised world against swelling hordes of desperate migrants? Part of it, I think, is just fashion. Once a critical mass of jet-setters have embraced a cause, others will naturally be attracted. Another part is the opportunities for status display. Even the humblest climate cultist can drive an electric car. If you are a royal, you can heat the palace with solar panels. If you're a politician, you can promote world-saving legislation. All right, but why is climate change the gnat and mass migration the camel? After all, there are opportunities for status display in mass migration too, as witness the trend of elite women adopting third world infants. So why the silence on mass migration when everyone's twittering about climate change? Is it race? Is it because the inevitable, and it really does look inevitable, the inevitable course of events leads to the civilized nations of the world 20 or 30 years from now defending their borders with major force against great hordes of desperate migrants, most of them black? I doubt that. The great and the good are too innumerate to grasp the inevitability there. And all respectable people in the Western world have trained themselves never to think about black people in any other than uplifting terms. Part of the answer, I think, is in humanity's religious instinct. Climate change is easy to work up into a cult. You can feel yourself and your fellow cultists to be righteous, waging war against sin. You can display emblems of your righteousness, your solar panels, your electric car. And there is, as with Marxism, there is a new Jerusalem to look forward to, a world without sin, the world in which the climate has been stabilised. The coming mass migration crisis, by contrast, doesn't lend itself to that kind of cultification. What would it mean to be righteous about it? Let them all in. That might work. And there are a few enthusiasts. Some of the crazier kind of economists, like Brian Kaplan, for instance. But it doesn't have much market share. I suspect, though, that most of the answer is political suppression. The progressive regime doesn't mind people babbling about climate change. It doesn't interfere with anything that they want to accomplish. And, as a side benefit, it gives them opportunities to look busy and virtuous without actually breaking a sweat. Mass migration, though, is a key part of their agenda. Their secret agenda. Why do you think they're flying migrants into red states at 3 o'clock in the morning? This is something they want to keep going, to feed their donors with cheap labour, and to replace the obnoxious, uppity, spoiled, lazy legacy population with a more submissive kind of serfs. To keep it going, though, they have to keep it quiet. Chatter all you like about climate change, but if you chatter about mass migration, the regime will frown. Then they will close your PayPal account and your Facebook account, they will cancel your conferences and intimidate your lawyers and your accountants. Gnats may be strained at as noisily as you please. Camels must be swallowed in silence. I assumed, before it got underway, I assumed that the trial of Kyle Rittenhouse in Kenosha, Wisconsin, would be just another show trial to pacify the diversity gods. The sacrificial victim would be led up the steps of the temple pyramid, laid on a slab, and have his beating heart ripped out and shown to the mob. It's true that there wasn't any real diversity in play. Rittenhouse and the three guys he shot, two of them fatally, were all white males. Heterosexual and binary, so far as I know. Those three guys were, however, Antifa and or BLM rioters. Antifa and BLM are the muscle of our ruling class, street enforcers of the progressive narrative, and so honorary diversity on that account. An offence against them is an offence against our state ideology, against our gods. So Rittenhouse's trial and conviction should have been a mere formality, as with James Fields, Michael Slager, or Derek Chauvin. It hasn't worked out that way at all. The prosecutors were all ready to play their part, but the presiding judge, Judge Schroeder, seemed not to want to go along. He actually cancelled some of their stunts in mid-stunt. Even the witnesses didn't cooperate. Gage Grosskreutz, the one who survived being shot by Rittenhouse, in questioning by one of the prosecutors, admitted that Rittenhouse didn't shoot him until he, Grosskreutz, was advancing on him, Rittenhouse, with a gun pointed at him. That was so off script, it caused the other prosecutor to facepalm at his desk. Monday sees final summing up and the case going to the jury. On what we've seen in the courtroom and the extensive video evidence, Rittenhouse ought to be acquitted. The jurors may, however, be too scared to acquit. Judge Schroeder has ordered the jurors' names sealed, but a BLM activist, which is to say a government stooge, named Cortez Rice, told a local media outlet that, quote, "There's definitely people taking pictures of the jurors and everything like that," end quote. If that's true, modern facial recognition technology should make it easy to dox them. And even if the jurors do have the courage to acquit, Comrade Merrick Garland may step in with so-called civil rights charges, which would not be double jeopardy. Absolutely not. No way whatsoever. Perish the thought. Totally different thing. A civil rights prosecution would, however, affirm that white people have civil rights too. Comrade Garland may feel that's too high a price to pay for a conviction. So perhaps this time the feds will let an acquittal stand. Ah, the tangles of the law. Well, we should have some kind of result on Monday. Tony Evers, Wisconsin's thoroughly progressive governor, has authorized 500 state National Guard troops to be present in Kenosha in support of local law enforcement. That has Kenoshans asking rhetorically why the governor didn't call out the guard for the three nights last year when Antifa and BLM were burning the town. I say rhetorically because I think we all know the answer. Thursday this week was, of course, Veterans Day here in the States. Over in Britain, it's Armistice Day, a sort of Veterans Day and Memorial Day rolled into one. The date is always associated in British minds with World War I, Britain's bloodiest war. I generally play the lovely hymn O Valiant Hearts on Armistice Day. It's the hymn we sang at school assemblies to honour the war dead. This year, though, I thought we'd have a poem instead. The poem's title is MCMXIV, which is just 1914 in Roman numerals. The poet is Philip Larkin, one of the best mid-20th century British poets. Larkin, who was born in 1922, seems to have just been looking at old photographs of the young men lined up outside a recruiting office to enlist in August 1914. Some Britishisms need explaining. The Oval is London's main cricket ground. Villa Park is a big soccer stadium in Birmingham. Farthings and sovereigns were coins, now both extinct. Twist is pipe tobacco. The Doomsday Book was a great survey of English land and land holdings done in the 11th century for King William I. Here is the poem, read by the poet himself, Philip Larkin.
1914. Those long, uneven lines, standing as patiently as if they were stretched outside the Oval or Villa Park. The crowns of hats, the sun on moustached, archaic faces, grinning. as if it were all an August bank holiday lark. And the shut shops, the bleached established names on the sunblinds, the farthings and sovereigns, and dark-clothed children at play called after kings and queens, the tin advertisements for cocoa and twist, and the pubs wide open all day. And the countryside not caring. The place names, all hazed over with flowering grasses, and fields shadowing doomsday lines under wheat's restless silence. The differently dressed servants with tiny rooms in huge houses, the dust behind limousines. Never such innocence, never before or since, has changed itself to past without a word, the men leaving the gardens tidy, the thousands of marriages lasting a little while longer. Never such innocence again.
And now, our closing miscellany of brief items. Imprimis. Prompted to identify the traditions of the Royal Navy, Winston Churchill is supposed to have replied, "Rum, sodomy, and the lash." Churchill actually denied having said it, although he added, "I wish I had." Whether he said it or not, Churchill would surely have smiled to know that the US Navy has named a ship after homosexualist activist Harvey Milk. Milk was assassinated in November 1978 by a fellow member of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. The jokes write themselves here. The Babylon Bee ran a story headlined, quote, USNS Harvey Milk to be manned entirely by crew of underage boys, end quote. I'm not going to compete here. I'm just going to note in passing that the ship thus named is a, quote, replenishment oiler. No, wait, I can't resist. Are there any plans to use USNS Harvey Milk as flagship for a rear admiral? Sorry. Item. Has the word woke worn out its welcome? Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez thinks so, and who better to pronounce on the matter? James Carville had blamed what he called stupid wokeness for Democratic electoral losses on November 2nd. The Congress gal fired back that, quote, wokeness is a term almost exclusively used by older people these days. The average audience for people seriously using the word woke in a 2021 political discussion are James Carville and Fox News pundits. So that should tell you all you need to know, end quote. Disgracefully ageist, if you ask me. Item. Finally, I just note the passing of character actor Val Bisogno, who played John Travolta's dad in the 1977 classic movie Saturday Night Fever. Some of his lines have stuck in my mind for 44 years. One pork chop! We could have used the conversation. Val Bisogno was 95 years old. Rest in peace. That's it, ladies and gents. Thank you for your time and attention and for your good wishes. For the record, my nose is almost back to normal. Now for a sign-off song. I closed out last week's podcast with Gentleman Jim Reeves singing the great country classic, He'll Have to Go. Listeners who weren't around 60 years ago may not be aware that back then there was a whole genre of answer songs. So after Elvis Presley had a big hit with Are You Lonesome Tonight, Dodie Stevens recorded Yes, I'm Lonesome Tonight. After Roger Miller had a hit with King of the Road, Jody Miller, no relation, countered with Queen of the House, and so on. No surprise, therefore, that after Jim Reeves topped the charts with He'll Have to Go in early 1960, lyricists worked up an answer song. In the interest of gender equity, and to avoid accusations of toxic masculinity, here's Skeeter Davis reporting from the other side of the mating game. There will be more from Radio Derb next week.
Someone else is here, he'll have to stay. I have found another love I know is true, and he holds me much more tenderly than you. Loving you's not worth the price to stay.